From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. All right, our connection this hour was made on the south side of Chicago, where a young man grew up in a rather musical environment. Lee Kuntz started playing the piano at age 8, but not really because his parents thought he would love it. They were hoping that their daughter would become a great piano player, and if her brother did it, maybe she would want to do it too. That plot didn't really work out. She sort of ended up hating the piano, but Lee loved it. He played various instruments as he got older. His path took him to Columbia, where his mother has roots, eventually to New York City, Chicago, among other stops. And here in Rochester, Lee Kuntz is now the president and artistic director of the Gateways Music Festival, which is not only back next week, but maybe growing in a way that we're going to see 12 months a year. We could see the festival go to other cities. We could see it annually. This hour, we want to talk to Lee about his vision for Gateways, the plans there, his own musical journey as well, and how he envisions music entering the lives of young people and how we can really diversify music and classical music. It's great to have you back here. How are you?
I'm terrific, Evan. Thanks for having me.
So you got to take me back to the whole piano thing, because that is the best scheme that, you know, you want to, that if your sister was just see you playing,
that's
it,
right.
Naturally she's going to fall into it.
Well, and she's 10 months younger than I am. So I was born in January of a certain year, and she was born in December of the same year. So she really did everything I did. We were almost twins. And so my father, who was a pastor of a church, thought, well, it would be great to have an in-house piano player. So I'll get my daughter to be the in-house piano player. And to get her to do it, I'll give my son lessons, because she does anything he does. So, but it backfired.
It didn't work.
It didn't work.
She didn't want to do it. Now, what do you remember about it, though? I mean, did you love it immediately?
Gosh, that was a long time ago. I think there was something about the instrument. I think I fell in love with the sound of the instrument first. And I thought, well, how is that made? How do they make that sound? How do they do that? And then I loved the repertoire, and then I fell in love with just the whole process of making music on the piano. And in my father's church, you know, we did things from oratorios to hymns to gospel to everything. So it was this place where I, you know, learned how to play everything.
I asked that question about piano because every time I'm in a house that has a piano, I regret the fact that I can't sit down and play it. I do.
It's never too late.
See, I want to believe that. You really think so?
I do. Absolutely. I actually think that as adults, we have the ability to focus and concentrate in ways that kids really can't do. I remember when I first started playing the piano, if I could, at 8 years old, if I could stay there for 10 or 15 minutes, that was a long, long time. So the focus and the concentration that adults have, I think, is a benefit to learning the instrument.
Well, I'm inspired to hear that. But I also, I'm setting up a conversation that's going to happen throughout this hour, which is bringing more kids into music, into classical music, especially children of color, and how Lee views that opportunity and that really responsibility across the country. Because it's one thing to say, boy, it's hard to get kids to stick with piano lessons. It's another to say, how do we really increase diversity with intention? And so before we kind of work through more of Lee's story and how he views that mission, let's remind you what the Gateways Music Festival is, because it's back August 8th through the 13th. But Lee, it's got this rich history. It's growing now. What is Gateways?
Gateways is a now 24-year-old classical music organization that has as its mission to connect and support classical musicians of African descent, and specifically professional classical musicians of African descent. And our secondary mission, which is really primary as well, is to enlighten and inspire communities. So we want to be an inspiration to communities of all backgrounds, all races, all ethnicities.
Okay. And your vision for Gateways is sort of to take it outside of Rochester, to maybe keep it here for 12 years, to do it every year? I mean, what does Gateways become here?
Well, you know, this year, our 6 days here in Rochester this year, we will have 125 musicians here. We'll perform in almost 50 different settings. So in concert halls, in churches, libraries, community centers, houses of worship, retirement centers, you name it. We'll be everywhere. And of the 125 musicians that we bring this year, we had to turn away 200 who applied, but we weren't able to accept. So we know that there's extraordinary demand from the musician side, and we know that there are many out there, more out there. And on the audience side, folks have told us that they want more from Gateways, that Gateways should be more of a presence in Rochester. We just finished our strategic planning, and that's one of the things that kept coming up. The other thing that kept coming up is that the show needs to go on the road. Right? So more folks around the country need to hear and see this extraordinary thing that is happening in Rochester. So for our future, we first want to be an annual festival. We want a 12-month presence here in Rochester. We want to tour the country. And we want programs that enable us to meet the needs of more of the musicians who really feel like Gateways is an important part of their lives, that they want to be a part of Gateways. So we've got to expand the program. And that could take on lots of different kind of ways.
I want to ask you a question that I know it's a sensitive one, the way that will be posed, but I think your perspective is going to be important here, because there is sometimes, unfortunately, an assumption that classical music is a white person's music, a rich white person's music, that it is not accessible, that it's not even intended to be accessible. And back when Lee was on this program earlier this year with some of the other people who are involved with Gateways and telling these stories and talking about the festival, I heard from a listener who is African-American who said, I can't get around on classical music because for me, classical music is the music of white supremacy. And that's a strong statement, but she really felt that way. She felt that the history is so exclusionary that she doesn't want to teach her children, that she doesn't want her children in it. And I want to start with asking you how you feel about that.
That saddens me a lot. First, let me say that this music that we call classical music belongs to all of us. Regardless of our histories, our racial identities, our backgrounds, it's universal. It belongs to all of us. And in my estimation, it's not the music itself that's the problem and that has been the problem. It's what our societies, what our cultures have put around the music. Many of this country's orchestras were founded by societies, right? And they were called that for a reason. There was this group of exclusive people. In Chicago, where I'm from, and I worked for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, I think the official name, and I'm certain someone will call it and correct me, but it is the Society of the Association of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. That's what it was founded. It wasn't founded as the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. It was the Society of, or the Associate, something like that. And a lot of organizations were like that. And so it was this group of people around the country who in some ways, and I'm not saying this was the intent of everyone, but who did want to create this kind of exclusive experience. But the music really wasn't like that at the beginning. So classical music was accessible. It was part of the popular vernacular when it was contemporary, and it belonged to everybody. And some of the conventions that we have now that kind of make people think it's aloof or exclusive, the absolute quiet, you know, we have to play all four of the movements. And they used to intermingle pop songs, popular songs of the day, in between a Beethoven symphony and not even play all the movements in the 1890s. So we have to find ways, I think, to make the music more relevant to folks who are living and breathing today, as opposed to as it was 200 years ago.
And composers of color, musicians of color, have been in this world.
Absolutely.
For, you know, essentially going back many, many, many years. And one of our listeners this morning was asking if Gateways features music composed by composers of color, if there's sort of an ethos there that you are going to subscribe to, and how you create the programming and how you decide what you want to do.
Sure. You're absolutely right. People of African descent have been involved in classical music since the beginning of this thing we call classical music. In fact, we know because of the historical record, we can see it in the tapestries, but we know that Henry VII and Henry VIII of England had a black trumpet player in their court. one of the pieces that will play this festival is the first symphony of Les Chevaliers de Saint-Georges, who is an 18th century composer and conductor, Mozart contemporary, and who happened to be, in his time, the most famous and well-known musician in Paris, right? A man of African descent. So, you know, going back to the 15th century, people of African descent have been involved in this music, going back to the 18th century. And in a more recent history, there was a time in our Black communities when classical music was a vibrant part of the musical life, right? There were concert societies, there were orchestras, there were associations. And so that vibrancy, I think, is what we've lost in the African-American community. And so there used to be lots of diversity in music making in the African-American community here. And I think we've lost a lot of that.
If you want to see some of the performances for Gateways,
yes,
easiest way to check the schedule, and let's talk about some of what's coming up here. But why don't you get the audience sort of ready if
absolutely
they've got some time to spend to come out here?
Absolutely. In fact, we want you to be at every single concert, every single
That's
performance.
Good. Yeah.
There's something for the public every single day of the week. And you can find more about the schedule on our website, which is gatewaysmusicfestival.org. This particular festival, I think, is our most exciting ever. We'll start out with a panel discussion with the musicians of the Gateways Music Festival. So eight of the musicians talking about what their lives are like. They'll be talking about the historic place of classical music in the Black community, kind of just like your very first question. Where did Black musicians come from? Where did Marian Anderson come from? Where did Leontine Price come? Where did it come from? Where did William Warfield come from? They came from the Black community. So what did that community look like then, and what does it look like now, and where do we want to go in the future? So that starts out the festival. And then we go from there on Wednesday the 9th to a piano recital at 3:30, a chamber music concert on Thursday at 7:30 at Mount Olivet Baptist Church, an incredible open rehearsal, which happens to be a live broadcast with WXXI at 1 o'clock on Friday, which we are so excited about that. We'll be in the community again at Hochstein School of Music on Saturday evening at 7:30, and then in houses of worship all over Rochester on Sunday morning. And then our final concert is on Sunday, August the 13th at 4 o'clock in Kodak Hall at Eastman Theater with the full orchestra and with one of the most extraordinary pianists of the day, Stuart Goodyear, playing the Rachmaninoff second piano concerto. So in terms of music, it really doesn't get better than that. The program is just extraordinary.
GatewaysMusicFestival.org to see the full range of it coming up here again. The 8th through the 13th, and Lee Kuntz is the president and artistic director. He's my guest for the hour here. You mentioned chamber music.
Yes.
How about a little love for chamber music, which I'm a big fan. I always love when composers who, you know, are known more broadly for, you know, what the public consumes, the grand sweeping symphonies, but they've got this repertoire of chamber
yes.
music. Then you go, what is this? You know, that's always lights me up.
There are a couple of things that make Gateways really unique, and we've talked about a couple of them, and there are some more. But one of the things that makes Gateways really unique is this focus on chamber music. We have 42 chamber music groups this year. And in addition to playing in recital halls like Hochstein and Kilbourne and Hatch Hall, recital hall, they are also playing in venues around the city, in chambers. In fact, on Friday night and Friday evening at 5:30, we're playing in the City Council Chamber, right? We're playing chamber music in the City Council Chambers. So chamber music everywhere. We love chamber music. And we're playing everything from Amy Beach to Ravel to Jesse Montgomery, just from every part of classical music history, music will be performed.
One of the questions that we bring up from time to time is what classical looks like today. And one of the hard things to do is in the moment say, well, this is someone who's going to be known for hundreds of years. I mean, you figured that they knew sort of with with Beethoven. You wonder if Schubert and others had that same cachet. If the people go, well, this is pretty good, and then here we are a couple hundred years later going, wow.
Right.
You know, what is the challenge, especially in the community of African descent? Because you've got people doing wonderful things. Do you look around this country right now? Can you point to and say, this is extraordinary. This work is going to be remembered. This person is at the top of the field right now.
You know, that's a terrific question, and it's really a difficult one to answer. I think if anybody could predict who the stars would be and who would be in the history books, I mean, you could, you know, be a billionaire probably.
Yeah.
I think one of the perfect examples of that is Bach, who was forgotten for all those years, right? Until Mendelssohn kind of made this, not discovery, but kind of brought him back to life. And so here's a composer who many classical musicians think is, you know, the height, the pinnacle of this thing we call classical music. And, you know, he kind of disappeared after his time. So I think that you just never really know who some of the greats are. I think that the important thing is to give access, to provide opportunity for the voices to be heard, for the music to be heard. And that's what we do at Gateways.
Gateways is coming up the 8th through the 13th of August. My conversation with Lee Kuntz this hour. If you want to join the conversation, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. If you claim to love classical music, I think there's a little onus on you to be at some of these events next week, because they have a lot of opportunities for you to take in some of the music and to support what's going on out there. But let's go ahead and back it up here, because I think your experience with music is interesting to me, and I want to then talk more broadly about how you view the mission of bringing more people into music. So, you know, you grew up in this family that was very intentional. They wanted you to play piano. They wanted your sister to play piano. There was music, I'm sure, and it sounds like, in your life from the very beginning. You were in third grade. You didn't feel like the violin was a good fit. What happened there?
Let me first say that my parents are not musical. My mother is still living. My father's deceased.
Okay.
But my parents were not musical people. My father knew how to play one song on the piano. And we always knew when he was in a good mood, when he would sit down and play that one song and sing. We knew he was in a good mood.
Could he sing?
He had a good voice, actually.
Yeah.
He did, yeah. So music wasn't a real big, big part of our life growing up. But
okay, so but here they were, you know, trying to get you into piano, and you ended up, you know, appreciating piano. And I have read that as you kind of worked your way to other instruments, some were better fits than others.
Oh, so. Yeah. You mentioned the violin.
Yeah, what happened there?
You know, I think more than anything, it was that I had already fallen in love with the piano. And I think that was, if I really had to be honest with myself, see, you're making me be honest. I mean, I couldn't really fall in love with the violin because I was already in love with the piano. But that said, and as I've gotten older and I've worked in educational environments for kids, starting the violin and the high upper string instruments at a very young age is really important. So at one point in my life, I was the executive director of Third Street Music School Settlement in New York City. And I can't begin to tell you the number of kids who start the violin at age 2, age 3. And I think that there is something about just the physical construct of playing the violin that starting at that early age really works and makes sense. So I like to say that by age, what I think I was in the third grade, by that I was, you know, too old to start the violin.
Interesting. Because I think a lot of people would think, well, at third grade, you're starting early.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying too late.
Now, I think that for the upper strings in particular, so the violin, viola, you'll see the kids, many, not all, certainly not all, but many of those who go on to have professional careers started at very, very young ages. It's different for lower strings, cello and the bass. And those start older. And
just the size of them?
I think that's part of it, but I think also the physical nature of playing the cello is more natural, right? and the bass is more natural. You have this thing in front of you. You don't have to do this. Mm-hmm. You can't see me on the radio, but you know everybody knows what it looks like to play a violin.
Yeah.
And that's just the whole setup for the violin is a very, very particular thing. Winds and brass players generally start later as well because you generally need to have the lung capacity and you need to have your permanent teeth, right, before you start doing things with your embouchure. So those instruments are definitely great instruments for older beginners. But I would say that the violin is a harder instrument to start when you're older.
Is there any other instrument that you ended up loving like the piano?
You know, I love the organ. And I was forced to play organ in church.
That's like the piano's cousin, though.
Well, it is, but it's kind of like it's the difference between driving a car and flying a jet plane. a rocket to the moon. I mean, they're that different. And I studied organ, and I'll never be an organist, but I love, there's something about being able to capture every single sound and timbre of the orchestra, of the human voice, of everything on one instrument. And to hear an organ well played is one of my favorite things on the planet to do.
I think it was Robert Greenberg in one of his biographies of the composers who said that the violin is the closest thing to the human voice, mm-hmm. that it can sound that way. But you're saying the organ kind of gives you this great range, too, of expression.
It's in a different way. You know, the voice certainly has the... you know, the breath and the air that the human voice, has, voice. The violin can emulate that somewhat. But I think that for me, in fact, many pianists, we strive to play the piano like a singer. It's something that, and those of you who are out there who are pianists will know exactly what I'm talking about. We strive for that. Are you a pianist?
No, that's the thing. Like, I really want to be able to play.
Right.
Okay, but when you mean, when you...
Well, legato playing. That's what we just talked about, you playing the piano. The legato that you can get with the voice and the connection of notes and tones. The piano is a percussion instrument. And its tendency is to be a percussion instrument. You can bang away at the piano. But the best pianists, the things that we enjoy hearing from them mostly, is when they are emulating sounds that sound like legato singing. And it's a very, very difficult thing to do. When you listen to Horowitz, one of the things the first thing I notice is, oh my gosh, what a beautiful singing tone he has.
Singing tone to the piano playing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I want to hear what you're talking about. Next time we get together, I'm fascinated by this idea. Can I ask a really ignorant question, real basic here? This is where Lee's going.
No such thing.
Yeah. No. When you say sort of a singing tone with the piano, the only thing that I can possibly come to mind to kind of comprehend what you're saying is sometimes when you see people who are learning piano and they play very clinically, the doom, 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 as opposed to flowing more and expressing music and sort of feeling it as opposed to just seeing notes on a page and just kind of banging them out perfectly in time. And I wonder if there is something connected to what you're describing.
I think it is. I think you're exactly right. And it's something that for some pianists, it's a very natural thing. I don't think it was a natural thing for me. And it's something that I still work on and struggle with to this day. And I remember being a student here at Eastman, and you know, one of the things we talked about a lot as students, you know, how do you find this way to create this singing legato tone on the piano and the melody? Because on the piano, on a clarinet, other instruments, you're generally playing one line, just one note, one line. But on the piano, you can have all these other lines going on, and how does the melody sing? How does the melody rise above all that other stuff? And for some pianists, like I say, it comes naturally, and others really, really work hard at it.
We're getting down in the weeds, but having a great, great time doing it with Lee Kuntz, who's the president and artistic director of the Gateways Music Festival. Do you get to perform during Gateways at all?
Oh, no. Oh, no.
I mean, I assume the answer is no, but now we're talking so much about your piano playing.
Well, and it's interesting. You know, the founder of Gateways, Arminta Hummings, Adams Hummings, Dumasani, I think she rarely, if ever, played at the festival. And I'm not putting myself in her category at all. She, Juilliard trained pianist, a musical phenomenon. If anyone is interested, you can go to YouTube and hear some of her recordings of the Goldberg Variations. There's an interview with her done in the 1970s on WNYC in New York. You can look for that. And it opens up with her playing this extraordinary Bach transcription. And it's unplayable. And she does it as if it's, you know, she's making toast. It's just that easy for her. It sounds that easy. But she was an extraordinary pianist. And she rarely, if ever, played on the festival. And I often wondered why. Now that I'm kind of running it, I know exactly why. There's so much to do. The last thing that I can focus on is really playing the piano. So,
if you weren't so close to Gateways, I mean, do you play much in your spare time?
You know, I did until I started working more intensely with Gateways. I've been involved with Gateways since 1997. And when Armenta retired in 2009, she asked me to chair this new committee, Artistic Programs Committee. And we did the first festival in 2011. And so I had a full-time job at that time at Third Street Music School Settlement. And then Gateways became another full-time job. And at that point, I realized that I needed to slow down my playing. So I was doing some playing for a couple of really large choirs in New York City and some company of singers. And between Gateways and my work at Third Street Music School Settlement, I kind of backed out of my playing. But I still play, but I only play things that I want to play now. That's really nice.
Let's get our only break of the hour. We'll come back with Lee Kuntz, who is the president and artistic director of the Gateways Music Festival. GatewaysMusicFestival.org. It's the 8th through the 13th. And so you've got all kinds of opportunities next week to experience this. It is back next week. And in the future, as you've heard from Lee, it's probably going to be a growing presence in this community and maybe even elsewhere. Let's get that break and come right back with Lee. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, a group of Iraqi high school students is visiting Rochester. We'll talk to them about bridging cultural divides and how they are taking in news from around the world to distinguish between what is real and what is not. Then in our second hour, if you're a parent and you've ever wanted to get involved, more involved with your community, the Greater Rochester Parent Leadership Training Institute is growing. We'll tell you all about it on Monday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You, your eyes lit up there.
Yeah.
Tell me what you're hearing there,
yeah,
Lee.
I think that's the Margaret Bonds. Florence Price.
Megan Makwa and John Andrews will confirm for exactly what we're listening to. But go ahead, Lee.
It's the first symphony of Florence Price that we played last year, or in 2015.
2015, the last time there was a festival, because it's every other year.
Yeah.
Though, again, that could change as soon as when, by the way, the every other year.
Well, we're hoping that the next festival will be in 2018.
Okay.
That's the plan.
Yep. So, very good. So, and it's beautiful, by the way, what we're hearing here.
It is extraordinary. It's a great piece. And in fact, that piece was the first piece played by a woman composer of African descent by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra in 1933.
Wow.
Which is amazing, right? So she was living in Chicago at that time, and she was, I think her teacher was Margaret Bonds, who I first mentioned, who's another extraordinary black woman composer. But that piece was played by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra in the 1930s. Amazing.
Well, I got a question. Let's get a couple questions in from listeners, and then we're going to talk a little bit more about Lee's route through music here. David on Twitter says, does your guest have recommendations on piano teachers for older students? He says, I used to play. I have a Steinway. I need lessons, and I would also love to use the same person to teach my 9-year-old son.
Oh, that's terrific. There are awesome places in Rochester. This is in Rochester?
Yeah.
Awesome places. The Eastman Community Music School has a terrific program for children and adults, as does the Hochstein School of Music and Dance. Those are two extraordinary places. And there are others as well in Rochester, but those are two that I would highly recommend.
You have this interesting family background that I'm a little surprised here that your family wasn't even more musical. So you end up getting obviously very serious about music. You also spent some time in Columbia. You went to college in Columbia?
Mm-hmm.
Your mother is from Columbia.
Mm-hmm. My mother's family is from this island called San Andres. It's a Colombian island, which is in the middle of really nothing. It's 500 miles off the coast.
Gosh.
And actually closer to Nicaragua and Panama than it is to Colombia. But it's been a part of Colombia since there was a Colombia. It's been a part of Colombia. And my family has been on that island since the 1700s.
Wow. And how big is the island?
It's 7 miles long and about 4 miles wide.
How do you even get there?
You have to fly through Tegucigalpa or Panama City or San Jose, Costa Rica, or you can fly to the mainland of Colombia and then, you know, fly over. And it's a huge vacation spot for Central Americans and South Americans. If you say you're from San Andres Island to a Colombian, they all start screaming because it's where they all vacation. It's where they all go to get married. It's a big, big deal there. But so, yeah, that's where my mother's family is from. And I was a student at Oberlin, and I decided to take a couple of years off to go to college in Bogota because I felt I needed to know more about my mother's family, the culture. So even though I had been there before on San Andres Island, I felt like I needed to know about the mainland, right? Colombian. I need to know more about Colombian culture. And then I went to school in Bogota, which was extraordinary. But it turns out that the culture there is very different than the Islander culture that you know I grew up with and that I knew as a kid. It's a completely different culture.
How so?
For one, it's cold there.
It's cold in Bogota?
Well, I mean, we wouldn't think of it as cold here, but in San Andres, it's 80 degrees every day. It's 90 degrees every day. And in the evenings, you get these extraordinary trade winds. It's paradise. It's total paradise. And in Bogota, you know, it rained a lot. It was maybe 60 degrees every day. And so the Islander people, the costeños, we would freeze up in the mountains in Bogota in 60-degree weather. It was like freezing for us. But yeah.
and did you continue on a path of music when you were there, or was that more a sort of personal journey for you?
I did, you know, and I felt like it was also a good time for me to learn more about the Spanish language. So I actually was majoring in Spanish literature at university there. And I did play, and I took piano lessons while I was there so that I wouldn't lose too much time when I went back to Oberlin. But really, it was a personal journey. I got to spend time with my family on my vacations, and be a part of their lives in ways that I hadn't been before.
How is your Spanish?
It used to be very, very good. I don't speak as much as I used to, but it used to be very good.
It gets rusty, doesn't it?
It does.
It's like a muscle that atrophies.
Like everything. And when I talk to my family, of course, on the phone, and I have lots of family who are here in the U.S. now, but when I speak to them and we speak in Spanish, then it begins to come back.
How often are you, is it San Andres, you said?
San Andres, yes.
How often, when's the last time you were back there?
It's been a couple years.
Okay.
My life has gotten really kind of crazy and busy.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a little. But my cousin, one of my cousins lives in Chicago, and she's been here since the 60s. But we used to go every summer for the entire month of August. The entire month of August, we would go and spend at home.
And so I just wonder, given how hectic your life has been and how peripatetic it has been, you know, do you think about standing on that island? Does it feel like you're just literally on another planet or in another world, that just away from the maelstrom of everything?
And it is another world. It's a completely different world. And when I'm there, and I tend to get really wrapped up in my family drama because every family has drama. I remember the last time I was there, I got roped into playing for one of my cousin's weddings to this man that she'd never met before, who was coming from the U.S. I mean, just crazy, crazy stuff. But when I think about Sound of the Rise, I think about I'm calm there. I'm peaceful there. I feel at home there. It's an extraordinary place.
It's so instructive for all of us who almost never have moments of peace. Before we continue through Lee's story, I got to take a phone call, and it happens to be our friend Paul Burgett on the line. Go ahead, Paul.
Evan, hello. Listening to this conversation, I just found it irresistible to phone in and offer my comments about the Gateways Music Festival, but especially about our president and artistic director. I've had the privilege of being associated with the festival since 1995 and have known Lee since 97. And I think that this community, the Rochester community, and the world of classical music could not, and the festival itself could not be better served than it is by Lee Kuntz, our president and artistic director. I will say also that while he loves to go to San Andres in Colombia where he can be peaceful and calm, he probably wishes, given all that he has on his plate, that he could be there right now because his plate is so full with so much that's going on. But I simply wanted to acknowledge his fantastic work on behalf of the festival and to say to your listeners, we think that Gateways 2017 is going to be the most extraordinary Gateways Festival in its long 25-year history. And in this instance, not only because of the music, which is really what it's all about. It's about the performance and the creation of music that is brought together classical musicians of African descent, but the organization, not only by Lee, who is brilliant, but by a coterie of volunteers, both nationally and locally, in our artistic advisory committee and our program planning committee, which has helped to make this happen. We are largely a volunteer organization, and I think that the Rochester audiences will be thrilled by what they're going to hear next week.
Paul, thank you. Stay on the line, Paul. Go ahead, Lee.
Thank you, Paul. And I just want to make it sure that everyone knows that Paul was my dean when I was a student here, so we go back even before 1997.
Not sure he wants you to reveal that.
Well, because he was my dean, I do exactly what he tells me to do.
Well, and you know, there's an old saying that the older we get, the more like ourselves we become. Well, Lee was perfect in the mid-80s. So how you improve on perfection, I don't know.
And he knows the right thing to say all the time. Thanks, Paul.
Paul, it's great to hear you. Thank you very much, Paul. That's
absolutely.
Always great to hear from Paul. Paul Burgett from the University of Rochester, and he's another one of those guys who's got a great voice who radio broadcasters like me go, oh, come on, man. That's got to be really lovely for you to hear that because, you're from the south side of Chicago, family roots in Columbia. You know, Rochester has become kind of a home for you. But what does that mean for you to hear that the community has embraced you in this way with Gateways?
Well, it's terrific. And Paul, by the way, is the chairman of the board of Gateways, which is really extraordinary. His leadership has transformed the organization. He's been the board chair, I think, for 2 years now. Earlier in our conversation, I talked about some of the things that made Gateways unique. And one of them was chamber music. And the other one that makes Gateways really unique is that it has been for 24 years mostly volunteer-run, volunteer-led, volunteer-organized. The consultant that we use for our strategic planning has been in that work for arts organizations for 30-plus years, and he said he's never worked with an organization that has had that type of structure, and especially one that has been as successful as Gateways. So this group of volunteers is just absolutely extraordinary, and Gateways is where it is because of this group of volunteers. And I feel very fortunate. I'm a former Gateways volunteer. So even though I serve as the president and artistic director in a staff position, I've been a volunteer since 1997. So I really am one of the volunteers.
Stewart in Rochester writes to us and says that Frederick Douglass had a passion for playing the violin. He said some of his sheet music is on exhibit at the Rochester Science Museum. There's a famous photo of his grandson, Joseph, who was a concert violinist.
That is true. And that's an example of the importance of classical music or these instruments, these classical music instruments, which they predominantly are, the importance of those instruments in the Black community. It was common for folks to play the piano or the violin or other instruments in the Black community. And Frederick Douglass's grandson became the first Black kind of concert virtuoso in the country. And he toured all over the country playing the violin. But it was common for this music to be vibrant and alive within our communities. Minister Louis Farrakhan is an extraordinary violinist, right? It was a part of Black cultural life in this country, and it's something that many, many of us hope we can regain within the Black community.
You have said that you compared certain sort of the broad look at why don't we see more musicians of color in classical music, and then you drew the comparison to the NBA. You said, you know, a lot of Black kids grow up, boys and girls now, with the rise of the WNBA. And they have this idea that maybe they could do that and that basketball becomes sort of part of life. And the NBA and the WNBA have no problem attracting top talent. And tell me about why you framed it that way and what your hope is with classical music.
Yeah, I think that the importance of having a large pool to achieving high levels of excellence is essential. And certainly the NBA is a great example of that. There are boys and girls all over the country, millions of them, who are out on the court every day practicing and honing their skills. Imagine if we had that same number of boys and girls out there playing the cello or the clarinet. How would that affect the diversity of concert stages in this country? I think it would be completely different. When the NBA was founded, I think in the 1940s, I think there were no Black players. None, right? And that has a lot to do with historic segregation and racism in this country. But now I believe it's, 65-70%. Another example in the musical realm, though, is Asia. People of Asian descent have, in a wonderful way, they were underrepresented in classical music, and now they are not. And part of that is because of the extraordinary numbers who are learning to play musical instruments. I read a report recently that said there are 40 million kids in China alone learning how to play the piano. That's amazing. And so now when you look on stages in this country, orchestra stages and solo recital stages, because that pool is so large, these extraordinary musicians of Asian descent are well represented in classical music. And I think that's an example of why building and strengthening the pool is so important.
And how, though?
Yep.
How does it start? And frankly, you know, what's it going to take for that to actually start to happen?
Music is this weird thing. I mean, you can want to be a classical musician, and you know it might not happen for you, or you might have extraordinary talent, but you decide you want to be a banker instead, right? It's just this very, very fickle thing. So the important part for diversity, in my estimation, in the United States is, we have to provide access and opportunity for all children to experience playing a musical instrument. Going to a concert's great. Watching a video is great of classical music. But the actual experience of learning to play the instrument is what makes the difference. And there are not enough opportunities. There are too few opportunities in this country for children of African descent and Latino descent to learn to play these instruments, the violin, the viola, the cello, the bass, the clarinet and the oboe, the French horn, the trumpet, the trombone. There are too few opportunities. So in order to really make a difference on concert stages in this country, we have to see access at a much earlier age. And you never know What kid out there who gets that opportunity and doesn't even know they have the gift or the skill or the passion, and all of a sudden they turn into this, the next, who knows, Wynton Marsalis or the next, you never know. But until we can provide that access, I fear that the numbers will continue to be small in classical music.
That probably means stopping the practice cold of cutting art and music when there are budget cuts to be made, of treating it like a core subject.
Yep.
Right?
Absolutely. And in this country, there was a time when every kid, and it wasn't that long ago, because I'm not that old, but it was a time when in Chicago, where every kid in the third grade got a musical instrument. You didn't really have a choice. And 90% of those kids don't go on to become professional musicians, but they do go on to become people who appreciate music, of all different types of music, who benefit from, people use the term discipline when they talk about music, but I think it's different than that. There's this sense of accomplishment, knowing that if you work hard at something, you accomplish something. Well, that translates to math, too. That translates to the sciences. That translates to reading and literature. This sense of working hard and accomplishing something. So regardless of whether or not you become a musician, music has extraordinary benefits for kids.
What were some of the impacts of music you saw when you were in New York at the Third Street Music School settlement?
Right. Yeah. Third Street is a legendary school in this country. It was the first or the oldest community school of the arts, founded in the 1890s, community music school, with about, at least when I was there 3 or 4 years ago, 5,000 or 6,000 students from age birth up to the 90s. And what was special about, there are many things that are special about Third Street, but what was really special about it is that it created a community for kids and for adults, actually, because we had a New Horizons program there. It created this community for them because that community did not exist in most of their public schools. So they came to Third Street, they had their lessons, but there was also a vibrant chamber music program. So they were playing in chamber music. There's a vibrant orchestra program, and there was a vibrant winds, brass, and percussion band program. And so it became their musical family. And that, I think, was very powerful to see. And even, you know, the majority of kids didn't go off to become musicians. But that experience, I believe, changed their lives.
Yeah. Amazing stuff. Well, before we let you go here, let's hit the schedule one more time. So, listeners, we've been talking to Lee Kuntz from the Gateways Music Festival, which is August 8th. Through the 13th. That's 8th is next Tuesday, isn't it? Is that right?
It is. I just want to make sure. Soon.
It's bearing down on you now.
It is.
4 days away. So next Tuesday, so the 8th through the 13th. And as Lee said earlier, they'd like to see you at all of the events, but assuming you can't do them all, let's give them all kinds of opportunities. So why don't you walk us through the schedule?
Absolutely. On Tuesday the 8th, we begin with a musicians panel discussion at 7:30 at Kilbourne Hall. On Wednesday, the 9th, we'll have a festival piano recital featuring five of our extraordinary pianists at the festival. That's at 3:30 at Hatch Hall. On Thursday, the 10th at 7:30, we'll be at Mount Olivet Baptist Church for a chamber music concert. Open rehearsal on Friday, August the 11th, which will be a live broadcast with WXXI at 1 o'clock, and that's at Kodak Hall in Eastman Theater. And then our second chamber music concert is on Saturday, August 12th at 7:30 p.m., and it's at the Hochstein School of Music and Dance. And then on Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock in Kodak Hall at Eastman Theater, the full orchestra will perform Adolphus Harold Stork, Brahms, and Rachmaninoff. And we just learned yesterday that the East End parking garage will be free that day. So there really are no excuses. All Gateways Music Festival performances are free and open to the public, and now so is the parking.
Wow. Anna on Twitter says, Lee Kuntz is such a remarkable leader and mentor. We are so lucky to have him at the Eastman School. And Lee, I'll close with this kind of a question for you. Gateways is going to be successful if what?
Hmm. it's funny that, you know, Paul just got off the phone. I think that Gateways has been transformed over the last couple of years. And Paul is famous for saying, there's nothing that we could... there's no problem at Gateways that we couldn't solve with $5 million. I think that in order to do all the extraordinary things that the community wants us to do and that the musicians want us to do, the only thing holding us back is the resources.
So Gateways will be successful if the community continues to support it.
Absolutely.
These are free performances, but I know you have support from some people, and that helps bolster what you're able to do, yes?
Absolutely. And everything that Gateways has been able to do has been because of the support of this community. It's extraordinary. We were at one of our board meetings back in June. We talked about the amazing donor base that Gateways has. There are 400 or 500 individual donors alone. And for a small organization like that, like Gateways, that's extraordinary. So we're very grateful.
I will say this. There's no problem that WXXI has that can't be solved with $5 million. Listeners, come on. You say you support WXXI and member-supported public radio. I know Gateways feels the same way. I joke, but I'll tell you what. What they have been able to do and what Lee Koontz's vision for Gateways Music is something extraordinary. And we'll see you next week there. But Lee, I know it's a busy time for you. It's our great pleasure having you. Congratulations on all the success in advance, because I know you'll deserve it.
Thanks so much.
And
it's great to be here.
GatewaysMusicFestival.org, all the information. That's Lee Koontz. Our thanks to John Andrus, the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a wonderful afternoon and weekend, and we're back with you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.